Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Tuesday, and it's January 15th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard here out of Yonkers. Our special guest is David Rubin. He was the former mayor of Shiloh, or as they say in Israel, Shiloh, Israel. And he recently wrote a book called Trump and the Jews. And we're going to open up the broadcast with him today to discuss some of the issues that were brought up in the book itself. He's a prolific writer. And one of the most important issues, of course, is the Trump doctrine in the Middle East. So good morning, David Rubin. How are you?
Good morning. Good to be with you.
My pleasure. So tell us, in your most recent book, and you're such a prolific writer, I can't believe how much you've accomplished. I'm still contemplating my first book, but I don't even know what to write about, and you've figured it out. So in your latest book, it discusses the Trump doctrine, and what is it? How is it defined in the Middle East?
Well, we have to remember with Trump that he has gone about things in a very different way than other presidents before him, and what he's been doing in the Middle East is very different. So because it's different, he gets a lot of criticism. Because it's different, he gets a lot of things that he does are questioned, but the fact is that what he's doing is very methodical. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he has done away with a lot of the assumptions that of the presidents that have come before him. For example, they've always spoken and pushed and promoted, at the cost of billions of dollars, I might add, the land for peace formula. That Israel has to give away its heartland, its biblical heartland of the country. And you have to remember, Israel is about the size of New Jersey. So to give away a big piece of its central mountainous region and hand it over to Islamic terrorists is about the most foolish thing, and it has no potential of succeeding. So Trump hasn't. What were you going to say?
No. Go ahead. Finish your thought. No problem.
Yeah. So what?
Trump
so what?
What?
So what? So what? What Trump says is, hey, that's not going to be the focus of my Middle East policy. The focus isn't going to be the land for peace formula in order to make peace. He goes about peace in a very different way. And the way that he has gone about peace is by getting the various players in the region to work together, meaning that instead of focusing on the Palestinians and creating a new state for the Palestinians, and we could discuss the relative merits of that or non-merits, but but instead of focusing on that, he has focused on getting the various countries that are positive for American goals to work together, such as Israel, such as Saudi Arabia, such as the other Persian Gulf countries, such as Egypt. Now, all of these countries are very concerned about the harmful influence of Iran and Iran's support for terrorism around the world, and especially in the Middle East. Iran's focusing on building up its nuclear program and attaining a nuclear bomb and attaining the missile power to launch those missiles overseas, not just in Israel. So all of these things, they separate President Trump. They distinguish President Trump from the past presidents.
And what are the prospects, for example, I think it's in mid-February that there's going to be a meeting of the countries you mentioned, like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Morocco and quite a few others. And so what would be the purpose of that, to actually make them a balance to the power that comes out of Iran? Because, like you said, Iran is supporting ISIS has certainly facilitated them.
All of the terrorist organizations.
All of that. So, are the Arab countries starting to recognize that there's a problem here with Iran, or is this strictly a religious divide?
Well, it's both. There is a religious divide because Iran is a Shiite Muslim country, and most of the other countries in the Middle East are Sunni Muslim countries, and certainly the more conservative Muslim countries in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. So those countries are very, very concerned about Iran. They have been concerned about Iran for a long time. And it's not just because they're Shiite and the others are Sunni. The main reason is because Iran is trying to take over the Middle East. It wants to dominate the Middle East and eventually the whole world. You have to remember, going back about almost 40 years, there was the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And under the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini, and his goal clearly stated, and it has been stated by his successor as well, the one with the familiar name, Ayatollah Khomeini, but they're different people. This goal is to export the Islamic Revolution around the world, and that is a big concern for the other countries in the Middle East. Even though they are Muslims, they are not Shiite Muslims, they're happy to have their little kingdoms.
People. Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, hasn't Iran's influence in Lebanon has simply torn the country apart? Syria is also just in total disarray, and yet they've got a pawn in Qatar. They use them and they push them out of to be one of their friends and so on. And that's caused a rift in the Arab world. Is everybody fighting to undermine the Middle East? What are they fighting
for?
Well,
you have to remember that the Iranians have been methodically trying to change the Middle East in their image.
Yeah.
And the other Arab countries are very concerned. They are very, very concerned, more concerned than Israel even, because they don't want to be dominated. No, you know, it used to be you had all these Arab countries and they, you know, each with his own king, and nobody would get in the way of the others, but since the Iranian Revolution, you have this Ayatollah, these religious fanatics in Iran, and they're looking to take over everything, and that's not something that countries like Saudi Arabia, who are very comfortable with what they have and very comfortable with their kingdom and their oil wealth, they don't want Iran taking over.
No. Do you find that the President Trump's concept of how the Middle East should evolve into the future, has that emboldened countries to seek out better relations with Israel, like the Omanis evidently recently had a very good connection with Israel and other countries as well? Israel is closer now to Saudi Arabia than it's ever been. even though it's still under, you know, like it's not like very public, but it's there. And Egypt is holding on to its peace treaty with Israel. And Jordan seems to be a little bit ambivalent and stuff. But how is this all working? Oh, does Israel have good relations with Morocco and stuff like that?
Well, it's been covert. Everything has been covert up until recently. The relationships have existed. There have been private meetings, very private, very secret meetings between Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and, you know, a couple of other leaders, the Emir of Oman, and of course Saudi Arabia, but it's all been very secret. In the past year or so, we've had a change, and I wrote about this change, by the way, in my book, Trump and the Jews, in which I spoke about the relationship between Saudi Arabia. All of a sudden, Saudi Arabia is talking about how Israel has a right to exist publicly. And all of a sudden,
Oman,
you have
too.
Oman, Bahrain. The leader of Bahrain has spoken publicly about how Israel has a right to defend itself, and Israel should be able to attack Iranian forces that are trying to entrench themselves in Syria. This is something that's obviously been in the news.
Well, this recently came out. Even President Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, said he admitted that Israel has flown sorties and destroyed Iranian arsenal, where they put in arsenals and other equipment like that. I don't know how they stored them, but Israel blew it up. How does the Arab world look at that? Are they pleased to see that, or are they?
Well, this
is
a first.
Just like upset. It's a first.
This is a first that the other countries in the Arab world are actually looking at this and looking at it very, very happily, but quietly. Most of the time they're not making public statements because this is. You have to remember this is the Jewish state attacking Muslim countries that they're at least they once were aligned with. Things have changed with Syria, but you have to remember at the same time Syria's Assad is an Alawite Muslim, which is an offshoot of the Shiite Islam. As I said earlier, the Iranians are Shiite Muslims, so. They're more aligned with Assad in Syria. The Iranians are, and when Israel attacks Iran, which is entrenched in Syria and trying to build up powerful military bases in Syria from which to attack Israel, and that's something that countries like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Oman, Egypt. They all look positively on this. Even Jordan looks positively on it. But King Abdullah in Jordan is a little bit weaker than the others. So he will never come out with a public statement, even though he officially has peaceful relations with Israel.
Right. Well, I guess it seems like we're heading in the right direction for just having a meeting of the minds of coexistence in the Middle East, or is that just a pipe dream still that may be another generation off?
No, it clearly is happening. It's a very new happening, so it's very delicate, and everyone is kind of feeling their ways. But this conference that Secretary of State Pompeo is trying to organize, which is going to be based in Warsaw, Poland, which is that too is groundbreaking. A European country is willing to go out on a limb and support this process. So it's all good, and it's not going to make Israel and all of these Muslim countries close friends. But what it will do is that it will help them to find their commonality of interests. And you know, you don't have to share the same values in order to work together. You do have to share the same interests, and you have to have a commonality of interests, shall we say. And there is an important commonality of interest here between Israel and some of these Arab countries.
Is Israel's reaching out to so many countries? Like, does it make a difference if a country like Brazil says they're going to be moving the embassy to Jerusalem? Is this important on the world stage?
Yes, it's always been important to Israel, and it's important to every country to have recognition. Every country wants to be appreciated. Every country wants to have its rights acknowledged by other countries. It's one of the basics of international relations, and Israel has long been somewhat of an outcast, certainly because of the Arab boycott of Israel over the years. But as we've just discussed, things are starting to change, and when it changes, it's really earth shaking, because it's like the old guards have changed, and the old alliances have shifted. And that now we have a situation where Israel and these Arab countries are finding their commonality of interest. And as I explained in Trump and the Jews, they have the economic interests, and they also have now the strategic interests. So they are working together, yes. And in many cases, working together publicly.
And then what about the recent, it hasn't been recent, it's been quite a few years that they've been exploring for gas off the Israeli coast. And evidently Israel's building a pipeline that goes from Israel to Cyprus to Greece. Is this going to be a very powerful mechanism for collaboration, and also very financially powerful? And
exactly.
Gives also
exactly.
Europe an alternative to the gas and the oil that comes through from Russia.
Both of those goals will be reached by this. Israel is on its way to becoming an oil and gas exporting nation.
Yeah.
And specifically gas. Gas is the first energy source that Israel has been developing very extensively. Oil is on the way, but gas, in terms of gas, Israel is really on its way to being an a gas exporting country, and the cooperation between Greece and Cyprus. Has reached levels that are quite remarkable, and it's counter to the hostility of Turkey. Israel once had a very good relationship with Turkey, and that has changed under Erdogan's leadership. But Erdogan has a very tense relationship with Greece, and with Cyprus. So this is a way of countering that by strengthening Israel's relationship with Cyprus and Greece, and at the same time having it be economically productive for all three countries.
Right. And then I heard also that I read, I think maybe in the last month or so, that Egypt also worked out an agreement with Israel with regard to gas. So they're looking to involve it. Is it conceivable that oil and gas will become the most important and crucial ambassadors? I mean, money speaks everywhere, so and usually can eclipse even religion and animosities. because there's a need. Is this conceivable? Is that where we're heading?
Well, it doesn't always work.
No.
You could look back at the approach of keeping the Palestinians happy by helping their economy, which has been the approach of Prime Minister Netanyahu. It doesn't always work, and it really hasn't worked so well. I mean, they still are supporting the terrorists and still supporting Fatah, still supporting Hamas. So in the Palestinians' case, it hasn't worked. But in terms of the other countries, yes, it absolutely is working. And their interest is the interest of most of the Arab leaders is to have quiet in their countries and to have peace in their relationships, so that they can continue to live on the level that they live and keep their people healthy and wealthy. And that's really what countries in the Persian Gulf want in particular. Egypt would like to get to that point. Egypt, unfortunately, for Egypt, it's not a it's actually a very poor country. But they do want to have strategic security, and that's something that Israel can give them.
Is Israel being challenged now, from the north with the Lebanese not being able to control their borders so much, and what's going on with Syria and the influence from Iran and their Bedouin that are on the southern front? Is it conceivable that Israel can be strong enough to hold out on so many different fronts being challenged?
Well, the north is the most dangerous.
Right.
And that's pretty much understood in Israel. Yes, the Hamas in Gaza make a lot of noise, and they make a lot of trouble, and they will have to be dealt with eventually. Dealt with meaning militarily. They will have to be stopped. But in the north, that's where the real dangers are, because that's where Iran is active. You know, Iran may support Hamas in Gaza financially. We know they do, but in the north, Iran is active militarily, and that is the big danger. Iran's military presence in Syria, where they are making all kinds of efforts and have been for a couple of years to really ensconce themselves in Syria, to really build up their military bases in Syria. Israel has been attacking Syria, usually covertly, and not making a big fuss about it. But it seems like every couple of weeks there, in the past year, there has been an Israeli air attack on Iranian or Hezbollah forces in Syria. And as for Lebanon, which is just to the west of Syria, Lebanon has pretty much ceased to be a country. Hezbollah is in control in Lebanon.
Yeah.
And so they have 150,000 missiles pointed at Israeli cities as we speak. And that's something that Israel just can't allow. They've been trying to build tunnels underneath Israel, underneath Lebanon, leading into Israel, and Israel has finally been working to stop that and blow up those tunnels, and that has been happening in recent weeks.
I heard they found just one only. The last one they found was the sixth tunnel. They blew that up.
Correct.
I think yesterday, the day before.
That's correct. So there's a bit of controversy, a bit of disagreement about whether that is the last tunnel. There may be others.
Sure.
But we'll see. We'll see what's going to happen. But the north is where the real dangers are, and that is where the Israeli government and military are going to have to be putting their attention in the coming weeks and months.
Do you think, though, with this new policy coming into place, as it has emboldened certain countries to do even quiet relations or building relationships with Israel. Why is there so much consternation and I guess negative responses to Israel that's coming out of Europe? Is there something that Israel is doing that upsets their sensibilities? Or is that just, you know, written up in some press and is not all quite legitimate there? What's driving this animosity?
Well, it's mostly the European Union. You have to remember the European Union, which is, you know, an amalgamation of all or most of the European countries, it's a body that acts on its own pretty much, and much to the dismay of most of the Eastern European countries who don't agree with the way of the European Union, and they, for instance, they have their open borders policy, and because of that, they've had a lot of Muslim immigration, illegal immigration that has flooded into their countries and created cultural havoc, and that's something that so Europe, the policy of the, it's been dominated by the policy of the European Union, which is far left of center, and unfortunately the left of center is not pro-Israel in our times, and we've seen that in the United States,
yeah,
and it's true in Europe as well.
Yeah, but it's something that's been growing in the United States. Does that look like it's becoming really quite powerful?
Well,
attitude?
Europe
in the
is
US.
Ahead of the United States in that respect.
Yes.
But the United States is catching up, and the far left is something to be concerned about. If you look at those who have been in favor of the BDS movement, the boycott, Israel movement, that it's mostly those on the far left, and especially these new Muslim congresswomen and plus Ocasio-Cortez, and people like them, they are far to the left of the Democratic Party. And they are quite anti-Israel. They are knee-jerk anti-Israel, and they don't know why. They're just knee-jerk, except for maybe the Muslim congresswomen. They don't know why they are anti-Israel. Ocasio-Cortez. They asked her about why she seems so anti-Israel, and she gave that silly laugh, and she said, "Well, I'm not the expert on the geopolitical politics," she doesn't know. She just doesn't know what she's talking about. And most people on the far left just spew out their anti-Israel mantras, and they don't know why they are anti-Israel. They're speaking from ignorance, and that's why it's important for everyone else to be aware. So that ignorance can be countered. And that's why I always tell people to go to my website, which is davidrubinisrael.com, and find out about my books, about my book Trump and the Jews, my book Peace for Peace, my book The Islamic Tsunami, all of them. Find out, get information, read Trump and the Jews, recommend it to your friends, and find out what is really happening today with the far left in America. Find out what is happening today in Israel and the Middle East, and then you'll be able to respond to the anti-Semites and the other critics.
Very, very compelling, Mr. Rubin. Well, I hope we'll be able to continue this conversation at another time, at a future time as well. I see our time is basically up, and I very much appreciate your making the time for our audience. Thank you so much, sir.
You're very welcome.
Be well. All the best.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, there we have it, folks. The author of Trump and the Jews, none other than David Rubin. He's got so many other books that you might consider reading as well. And very, very compelling. This gives you a very good sense of, and a balance as well, between American concepts. He was originally from the United States, and now he lives in Israel. And he was even a mayor of Shiloh in Israel. So it's a beautiful marriage in the sense that you get the, I guess, the complexity and the dualism of thinking, American thinking on the one hand, and also the thinking in Israel on the other hand. That doesn't mean that it encompasses everybody, but certainly a good number of people are, I guess, more comfortable hearing an American voice on Israel that's not exclusively an Israeli, but is an Israeli now. So very, very intriguing. And I think a lot's going to be told as we approach the election in Israel for prime minister. We'll see which parties jockey into position and take the preeminent position there. It's going to probably say a great deal about the direction of the country into the future, dependent on who will become the next prime minister. It does look like Benjamin Netanyahu is in the lead, that's for sure, at the moment. But you never know. Politics is politics, and you never know who the bedfellows are. And they're always strange, that's for sure. So let me quickly go back to our studio screen and just get back to finding out a little bit more about the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a stenopad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834. Or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Well, there's another number you can reach out to the Yonkers Tribune if you'd like. It's 347-415-4326. 347-415-4326. Let's find a little bit. We were talking about Iran, so let's find a little bit more about what's going on. And just bear with me a moment. Evidently, Iran has failed to launch a satellite into orbit after ignoring warnings from the United States. So Washington was concerned that the long-range ballistic technology could also be used to launch nuclear missiles. Iran's attempt to launch a satellite failed to reach orbit. The country's telecommunications minister advised the rocket carrying the Payam satellite, PAYAM, failed to reach the necessary speed in the third stage of its launch, Mohammad Yavad Azari Yahromi told Iranian state television. Mr. Yahromi said that the rocket had successfully passed its first and second stages before developing problems in the third. He did not elaborate on what caused the rocket failure, but promised that Iranian scientists would continue their work. It came after Iran ignored U.S. warnings to avoid undertaking three planned rocket launches that Washington said would violate a United Nations Security Council resolution because they used U.S. is concerned the long-range ballistic technology used to put satellites into orbit can also be used to launch missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads. Iran, which considers its space program a matter of national pride, has said its space vehicle launches and missile tests were not violations and would continue. Payam was intended to be used for imaging and communications purposes and was mounted with four cameras, according to a report on the Telecommunications Ministry's website. It was also intended to stay at an altitude of about 5,000 kilometers, that's about 300 miles, for approximately 3 years. It was one of two satellites Iran planned to send into orbit. The other, named Dusti, and Payam means message in Farsi, while Dusti means friendship. Over the past decade, Iran has sent several short-lived satellites into orbit, and in 2013 launched a monkey into space. Iran usually displays space achievements in February during the anniversary of its 1979 Islamic Revolution. This year will mark the 40th anniversary of the revolution, amid Iran facing increasing pressure from the United States under Donald Trump's administration. And that was exactly what Mr. Rubin had mentioned, in a sense, the 40 years that have passed. My goodness, when you think about that, that's very, 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 very compelling. Just mind-boggling, to say the least. Well, this is going to be very interesting on the U.S. front. Wanted to point out that Kirsten Gillibrand, who was a guest on the Colbert Show, said that she's moving toward a presidential run. So Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York will be a guest on Late Show with Stephen Colbert today, leading to speculation that she will use the platform to announce that she's forming a presidential exploratory committee. To announce on The Late Show would be a bit unusual, as campaigns have usually debuted with carefully scripted web videos, as Hillary Clinton did in 2015 and Senator Elizabeth Warren several weeks ago in announcing the formation of her 2020 committee. But it is not new. John Edwards announced that he was running for president in 2004 in an appearance on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. But if she announces on Colbert, Gillibrand would draw on the more relaxed atmosphere of late-night comedy and on the most watched of all talk shows. She's comfortable in the format, as she was most recently on Colbert on November 9, and she also guested on the show in February. Tuesday will be her third appearance on the show. As The Atlantic's Edward Isaac Dover wrote, quote, Gillibrand's media strategy, beginning with a relationship with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show that grew out of their work on the 9/11 health bill, has always been much more rooted in late-night comedy shows than cable news hits. And Colbert has been booking a series of possible 2020 presidential contenders, not just Gillibrand, but Senator Amy Klobuchar, a Democrat from Minnesota, in November, and Senator Kamala Harris, Democrat of California, last week. And Gillibrand and Warren are expected to join a large field of Democrats. Former Secretary of Health and Human Services Julian Castro announced a presidential bid over the weekend, and former Representative John Delaney launched his campaign in 2017. Representative Tulsi Gabbard, a Democrat of Hawaii, she appeared on Van Jones' CNN news show on Saturday and said she planned to enter the race. So when you think about it, there's a lot of already people moving into the just moving in. So which is really very interesting. And it's going to be very compelling to see where that goes. Okay, so let's quickly move on. Evidently, the United States and the Turkish presidents have discussed creating a security zone in northern Syria. Well, it seems that Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the U.S. counterpart Donald Trump mooted on Monday the creation of a security zone in northern Syria as tensions rose over the fate of Kurdish fighters in the war-torn country. In a telephone conversation, the leaders, quote, discussed the idea of creating a security zone cleared of terrorism in the north of the country, the Turkish presidency said in a statement. Now, Trump confirmed this in a tweet later, but referred to the proposed area as a safe zone. This came after Turkey vowed it will not be intimidated by Trump's threats of economic devastation if Ankara attacked Kurdish forces as U.S. troops withdraw from Syria. Now, Trump on Sunday warned the U.S. would devastate Turkey economically if they hit Kurds. Ankara has repeatedly threatened to carry out a cross-border operation against the Kurdish People's Protection Units, the YPG, which have been working closely with the United States in the war on Islamic State jihadists. So the White House said in a statement that Trump had warned Erdogan against harming Kurdish military units. The president expressed the desire to work together to address Turkey's security concerns in northeast Syria, while stressing the importance to the United States that Turkey does not mistreat the Kurds and other Syrian democratic forces with whom we have fought to defeat ISIS, White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders had said. But in his subsequent tweet, Trump put out a more positive spin, noting that he and Erdogan, quote, also spoke about economic development between the United States and Turkey, great potential to substantially expand, he said. The strained relationship between Ankara and Washington initially seemed to improve after Trump announced last month that 2,000 U.S. troops would withdraw from Syria. Ankara welcomed the decision, and Erdogan told Trump that Turkey would finish off the last remnants of Islamic State. Trump has been pushing for the creation of a 20-mile safe zone in Syria. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said on Monday that talks were underway on Washington's proposal to establish the zone in flashpoint border areas of northeast Syria. Quote, we want to make sure that the folks who fought with us to down the Islamic State group have security. Also, the terrorists acting out of Syria aren't able to attack Turkey, Pompeo said in a visit to Riyadh. They were in Saudi Arabia. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu also earlier said that Turkey was not against a security zone in Syria. And in their conversation on Monday, Erdogan assured President Trump that Turkey was ready to provide, quote, any kind of support, end quote, to the United States in its withdrawal from Syria. Turkey viewed the YPG as a terrorist offshoot of the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, which has been waging an insurgency against the Turkish state since 1984. Again, that's like 35 years ago. The PKK is blacklisted as a terrorist organization by Ankara, the United States, and the European Union. Now, Erdogan's spokesman, Ibrahim Kalin, said that Ankara would, quote, continue to fight against them all, end quote, referring to Islamic State and the YPG. There has been growing tension between Turkey and the United States over the fate of the YPG, especially after Pompeo this month said that Washington would ensure Turkey does not slaughter, quote unquote, Kurds. And before a visit to Ankara last week, White House National Security Advisor John Bolton said that the U.S. retreat was conditional on the safety of Kurdish fighters, provoking angry retorts from Turkish officials. Turkey previously launched military offenses in northern Syria in 2016 and 2018, respectively, against the Islamic State and the YPG. In early 2018, Syrian rebels backed by Turkish military forces captured the YPG's northwestern enclave of Afrin. So Ankara, which supports Syrian opposition fighters, is also involved in the last rebel bastion of Idlib, another province where Turkey has agreed to a buffer zone deal with Damascus ally Russia. But the deal has not stopped an assault by jihadists in Syria. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, an alliance led by jihadists from al-Qaeda's former Syrian affiliate, last week extended its administrative control over the whole of the Idlib region. Syria's National Coalition, the leading opposition party, a body on Sunday called for a radical solution to put an end to its HTS presence in Idlib. Cavusoglu, however, said the Idlib deal was being, quote, successfully applied, end quote, and that statements that HTS took 50% of Idlib are not true. So that's the complexity of what's going on there. And bear with me one second here. All right, well, bear with me a moment here. All right. I just wanted to make sure that we had some other things here to look at. Bear with me a moment as I pull something else up here. This just happened maybe an hour ago. A blast, gunfire, was reported at an upscale hotel complex in Kenya's capital of Nairobi. Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for an attack on an upscale hotel and office complex in the Kenyan capital of Nairobi today. An upscale hotel complex in Kenya's capital came under attack on Tuesday with a blast and heavy gunfire. Witnesses and police at the scene called it a terror attack. The complex in Nairobi's Westlands neighborhood includes a large hotel known as Dusted D2, banks and offices, several vehicles burned, people were being rushed, even carried from the scene. It is terrible. What I've seen is terrible. I've seen a human as I ran out of there is what looks like a minced meat all over, said a man who said he ran from the scene. Charles Njenga was his name. He did not give details. I've been hiding. My colleagues were running everywhere, said another man, breathing heavily, who did not give an Associated Press video journalist his name. He said he hid in an office. I didn't see an attacker. Yeah, I think so. Gunfire continued several minutes after the first reports black smoke rose from the scene. We have sent officers to the scene, including from the anti-terrorist unit, but so far we have no more information, police spokesman Charles Owino had said. Ambulances, security forces, and firefighters rushed to the scene, sirens wailing. A large group of women were hurried out by security forces, one woman still in hair curlers. Other groups of dozens of people were hurried away as plainclothes officers went from shop to shop in the complex. What appeared to be plainclothes security forces inched their way toward the scene, guns in hand, helicopters could be heard. Other people appeared to be taking cover behind fountains and other features in the lush outdoor complex. The attack immediately reminded many Kenyans of the Westgate Mall attack in Nairobi in 2013, when Al-Shabaab extremists burst into the luxury shopping center, hurling grenades and starting a days-long siege that left 67 people dead. The attack came 3 years on the day after Al-Shabaab extremists attacked a Kenyan military base in neighboring Somalia, killing scores of people. The Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab objects to the presence of Kenyan troops in the turbulent Horn of Africa nation. So that's what was going on, that's for sure. Just a frightening circumstance, to say the least. Bear with me a moment as I want to look into this. One second. Quickly move to see if anything else has transpired. All right, bear with me one moment here. I've got to check, whoops, wrong place. Here it is. This is very interesting because, again, this is in our hemisphere. Brazil's Bolsonaro has signed a decree easing gun laws. seems that Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro today signed a decree that will temporarily make it easier for Brazilians to buy guns, despite fears the move would aggravate or could aggravate already staggering violent crime. The executive order, signed in a live television broadcast following a cabinet meeting, allows, quote, good citizens, end quote, to more easily own firearms, said Bolsonaro, a former army captain. The far-right president ran on a law and order platform. His message resonated with voters in Brazil, which in 2017 had a record 64,000 murders, more than in any other country. The leader has said he wants to overturn a 2003 law that was tantamount to banning civilians from purchasing guns. So, you know, it just is what it is. Bear with me a moment here. Yes, this is important because it relates to Venezuela. The Venezuelan opposition leader, Guaido, briefly was detained. So Venezuelan intelligence agents briefly detained opposition leader and National Assembly leader Juan Guaido on Sunday, said his wife and several opposition legislators. Guaido was released later in the day. Guaido on Friday said he was willing to assume the presidency after the opposition declared President Nicolas Maduro's second term to be illegitimate. Hours after reports of his detention circulated on Twitter and regional news networks, a Venezuelan congressional official told Reuters the opposition leader had been released after a brief detention. The confusing incident is bound to ramp up tensions between the opposition and government following Maduro swearing in for a controversial second term this month. A video circulating on social media purports to show the moment in which Juan Guaido is intercepted on his way to an anti-government citizens meeting in the port city of La Guaira. Now, in the video shot on a cell phone by a motorist stuck in traffic, several men in ski masks and carrying assault weapons are seen struggling to shut the door on someone being pushed into an SUV before racing down the highway. Well, when it was not possible to identify Guaido in the 33-second video, his wife said on Twitter that he had been detained by a commando unit of the feared SEBIN intelligence police. As news of his detention spread, he was then released. I thank everyone for the quick response in the face of abuse against my husband by the dictatorship, Fabiano Rosales had said in a message posted on Twitter. The dictatorship will not be able to bend his fighting spirit, end quote. Adding to the confusion, the government tried to shift the blame to Guaido's allies with Communications Minister Jorge Rodriguez, saying that the media show had perhaps been orchestrated to provoke an international uproar. Still, he acknowledged that police officers had partaken in the arrest and said they would be disciplined. We want to inform the people of Venezuela that the officials who took that upon themselves of being dismissed, Rodriguez had said on state TV. At the rally on Sunday after the incident, Guaido told the Associated Press that the Sabin agents informed him they were carrying out orders from above when they arrested him. We are survivors, he told the crowds of a few hundred waving Venezuelan flags. Reports on Guaido's brief detention came a day after the U.S. ramped up its criticism of Maduro with an explicit call for the formation of a new government in the country. The State Department said in a statement released on Saturday that it stood by Guaido, who had earlier declared he is prepared to step into the nation's presidency temporarily to replace Maduro. Now, the statement was the latest in a barrage of Trump administration attacks on Maduro, whose inauguration to a new term as president on Thursday has been widely denounced as illegitimate. The people of Venezuela to live in freedom in a democratic society governed by the rule of law, the State Department spokesman Robert Paladino had said, it is time to begin. the orderly transition to a new government. We support the National Assembly's call for all Venezuelans to work together peacefully to restore constitutional government and to build a better future. So the United States government will continue to use the full weight of the U.S. economic and diplomatic power to press for the restoration of democracy in Venezuela, he said in the statement, which was released in Abu Dhabi, where Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is currently traveling as part of it of a nine-nation tour of the Middle East. And Pompeo spoke to Guaido earlier in the week, shortly after the 35-year-old was elected to lead the National Assembly. So Guaido said he was willing to become interim leader when speaking to an energized, crowd really blocking a busy Caracas street a day after Maduro's inauguration. He said he would need support from the public, the armed forces, and the international community before trying to form a transitional government to hold new elections to replace Maduro. So the head of the Organization of American States, Secretary General Luis Almagro, announced quickly, sending out a tweet recognizing Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton then praised Guaido, although he didn't echo Almagro's step of calling him the interim president. Bolton reiterated the U.S. position that the May election that gave Maduro a second term was no free, fair, or credible, and said, quote, "We support the courageous decision of Guaido's declaration that Maduro does not legitimately hold the country's presidency." Guaido asked Venezuelans to mass in a nationwide demonstration on January 23, it's a historical and historically important date for Venezuelans, the day when a mass uprising overthrew dictator Marcos Perez Jimenez back in 1958. The Constitution signed the presidency to the head of the United Nations if Maduro is legitimate. But the overall military so far has remained firmly behind Maduro, despite some reports of small-scale attempts at revolt. A once wealthy oil nation, Brazil is gripped by a growing crisis of relentless inflation, food shortages, and mass migration. So 17 Latin American countries, the U.S. and Canada, denounced Maduro's opposition in a measure adopted Thursday at the Organization of American States in Washington. Well, my goodness. A lot going on in the world, huh? This is interesting because an ex-militant, his name is Battisti, has been extradited to Italy after his arrest in Bolivia. Listen to this report. Bear with me a moment.
After four decades on the run, the game is over for Cesare Battisti. The former communist militant is on a plane being extradited to Rome from Bolivia after being handed over to the Italian authorities on Sunday. Battisti was arrested on the streets of Santa Cruz after being spotted by a special team from Interpol.
He entered Bolivia through a non-authorized point. There's no certainty of when or where he entered the country, and there's no evidence of it.
The fugitive is wanted in Italy for his involvement in four murders in the 1970s, for which he was sentenced in absentia for life imprisonment. Italian Interior Minister Matteo Salvini hailed the arrest as a great success.
I want to thank the police forces, Italian, Brazilian and Bolivian, the Italian and international security agencies, for their great teamwork. Today we have broken the code of silence, complicity has failed and the climate has changed in Italy, in Brazil, in the United States. Now whoever makes a mistake is going to pay for it. Italians have been waiting years for this day.
The former leftist militant has always claimed he's innocent. After living in France for 15 years, he fled to Brazil in 2004, where he lived until recently with the support of former left-wing president Lula da Silva. But in December, former President Michel Temer signed an order for his extradition before handing power to Jair Bolsonaro, who pledged to return Battisti to Italy.
Well, a lot of stuff is going on, no matter how you look at it, all over the world. It's truly amazing. So I wanted to just check and see what else is happening. Evidently, this is really quite important. And this is Kumbh Mela. Millions are gathering in India for the world's largest religious event. And I think you'll find this very, very interesting. Bear with me a moment. Just in case you're not familiar with it, of course. One second. All right. One moment here. Okay.
This year's Kumbh Mela, and Prime Minister Modi is expected to attend by the end of March.
So anyway,
this is good.
Okay.
But there is also concern over the Nationalist Party's interests and consideration for other communities.
We are a democratic nation, so the government should work for everyone. If there's a Muslim or Christian festival, they should make arrangements for them, just like they're doing for Hindus.
Figures anticipate that up to 150 million devotees will make it to this year's Kumbh Mela, and Prime Minister Modi is expected to attend by the end of March.
Okay, so this is how it works. The organizers are expecting an enormous spiritual festival in Allahabad and attract more than 100 million devotees over the next 48 days with seas of pilgrims camped by the riverside. The ancient city in northern Uttar Pradesh, the state, rises alongside the banks of the Ganges, Yamuna, and mythical Saraswati rivers. And the confluence of the three, known as Sangam, is considered especially holy, and Hindus believe bathing there during the Kumbh Mela helps cleanse sins and bring salvation. The pilgrimage gives me a peace of mind and an opportunity to reflect on my life, said Sangeeta Gangotri, a pilgrim who traveled 403 miles from Nagpur in western Maharashtra state to Allahabad. The riverbank has transformed into a lot of noise and color. Naked, dreadlocked, holy men smeared in ash and sadhus clad in saffron robes wander the crowds, offering blessings to pilgrims who have traveled from every corner of India for the ritual dip. All the gods descend on this sacred place during this period. This is the most auspicious event for any human being, said Shandan Pandey, a 60-year-old devotee. I've been planning to attend for many years, he said. The last major gathering of Allahabad in 2013 drew 120 million devotees, organizers said, with 30 million plunging into the holy waters on a single auspicious day. Police have been deployed to oversee crowds for the huge undertaking and prevent stampedes that have marred previous gatherings. A tent city with restaurants, roads, and marketplaces have sprung up along the river, with pilgrims camped out across the sprawling 45-kilometer zone specially earmarked for the Kumbh Mela. And more people are drawn to the Kumbh Mela now. Ganesh Anand Baramashari, a 70-year-old pilgrim from nearby Varanasi, and a Kumbh Mela veteran advised. People mostly from cities are becoming increasingly religious because the Western life they were living has not led them anywhere. The Uttar Pradesh state government, led by a firebrand Hindu priest, has heavily promoted this year's Kumbh Mela, which comes as India prepares for a general election in April and May. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, whose Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party is in power in Uttar Pradesh, visited Allahabad in December to inaugurate a high-tech command center to manage the Kumbh Mela. The historic city was even renamed Prayagaraj in October by the state's conservative government, stripping its centuries-old Muslim moniker and replacing it with an ancient Hindu title. But the city is still widely known as Allahabad, the name given by Islamic rulers that reigned over India hundreds of years ago. The Mela, which runs until March 4, was recognized as an intangible cultural heritage by UNESCO in 2017. My goodness, so very, very compelling circumstance. Well, I see that we're at the end of the line for us today. Tomorrow is another wonderful day. It'll be the 16th of January. We're going to be speaking to Dr. Oren M. Levin-Waldman, and I think we may have another guest as well the following at 11 o'clock. I'm not quite sure. I have to recheck that, and we'll move from there. So we'll speak to you tomorrow, and I thank you for being with us today. What a pleasure. Okay, so where are we? Here we are. And let me shut this down. Okay,